Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, I'm going to have another conversation with Mark Lundy. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jörg. How are you?
I'm fine. And you?
Good, good. Thank you.
So we did have a conversation earlier where we looked at your experience, that is the experience of the business group at the Center for Tropical Agriculture in value chain promotion. And one of the issues that came up in that conversation that we couldn't pursue at that point because we were running out of time was the middleman. And we agreed that that is one of the issues that really are worth exploring a little bit more.
Yes, I think this is one of the developmental myths that's out there, and I think it's definitely worth looking at much more closely.
Yeah, it's one of the things that in our practice comes up all the time. I mean, when you look at the proposals that local people come up with, cutting out the middleman is one of the most, I think probably one of the most frequently mentioned things by local people, especially in agricultural settings.
I would agree, and I would extend that to say it's not just the local people who are very intent on cutting out the middlemen, but also oftentimes development agencies as well.
Yeah,
and
right.
when you involve the development agencies, there's almost at times a moralistic take that, you know, these people are bad and that they're leeches.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, it becomes a very charged discussion.
Right. Yeah. Maybe let's start by trying to describe what we mean by a middleman. How would you try to capture? And is there one typical profile of a middleman, or are there different types?
I think that's the first myth. The first myth is that the middleman is sort of a one size fits all description for somebody who gets in the way of you know, farmers making a good profit on selling onto a market.
Yeah.
In our work, we've come across a range of different types of actors who fall into the category of middlemen or middlewomen.
Right.
And so it's really hard to put them into a one-size-fits-all category.
Yeah.
I mean, one time in Honduras, we did an exercise with a group of farmers looking at coffee production. And when we were looking at the value chain, they came up with something like 13 categories of middlemen.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. And so you had sort of at the one end, you had sort of the farmer / middlemen.
Yeah.
And then at the other end, you had sort of the professional, international exporter type. And as one of the farmers said to me, he said, you know, brokers are just really well-established middlemen. And I said, yeah,
right.
Yeah, you know, and in Central America, the term they use, which I think is very telling about how these actors are viewed socially, is they're called coyotes.
Right.
So they're actually seen as sort of predatory creatures.
Yeah. Right. So when you have these different types of middlemen, and they are so frequent, where do they typically come from, in your experience?
Well, as I said, there's a huge range.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, if you look at sort of the close-to-farm middleman or middlewoman, which is another thing we definitely need to highlight, is it's not just men
right.
who do this. It's
right.
Oftentimes, there's a gender component here that's very important.
Yeah.
Again, that's culturally – that varies by culture. But anyway, usually the closer-to-farm middle people – tend to have sort of evolved from a farming focus where they've been fairly successful and have had the need to get additional surplus product into the market, and by hook or by crook they've begun to sort of test the waters in local markets or sometimes it's a bit further afield, and have found that that they're good at this, that they can actually make more money doing this, and it's a service that they can offer to their neighbors. And so that's one end of the continuum. At the other end of the continuum, the more professional or, full-time middlemen, some of them come from families who have been doing this kind of thing for many, many generations.
Mm.
Some of them basically see it as a way where they can, to make quick money. And others really come at it in a very, very much in a role of what we would consider a modern broker, where they see that there's a market failure,
yeah.
Between production and consumption, and they see a natural role that can be filled, and they take that opportunity.
Yeah,
so it really depends.
Right. It's interesting that you're mentioning the term market failure, because when I was doing some work on making markets work in recent years, I very often came across this profile, this issue of the middleman or the middle person, and I got the very strong impression, also based on our own work experience, that middlemen very often come in and play an important role in cases where markets just don't work very well, where markets would be very shallow, where you just don't have enough space to have various competing providers of key inputs or anything like that, and that then the middleman sets himself up or herself up as this solution to this market failure.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and the description you made of, or you just made of market failure describes in many cases what we find in rural communities throughout Latin America. Mm. And that leads me to another thing that we found with middlemen is they don't tend to offer only one service. It's not just buying and selling.
Yeah.
There's what I would call a basket of services.
Yeah.
That's offered. Some of which are loss leaders.
Yeah.
And some of which are very profitable.
Right.
Probably the commercial transactions are normally fairly profitable.
Yeah.
But there are other services that are provided, on top of the commercial services that really keep people interested in working with these actors.
Right.
So I mean, it ranges. I mean, as you well know, it ranges from being the godparent of the farmer's child, all the way to taking the spouse of the farmer to the hospital when she's ill, because the middleman's the only person who has transportation.
Yeah.
Loans at certain times during the production cycle, market intelligence, provision oftentimes of inputs and seed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole range of packing materials.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole range of services that are sort of go under this catch-all term of middleman, and when you begin to unpack them, they're actually in some cases very efficient providers of multiple services.
Yeah.
So to only label them as sort of market intermediaries is oftentimes I think it's very disingenuous.
Yeah. So if they play all these different roles, not just from a business angle, but also from a social angle, why are they so hugely unpopular in so many places?
Because, and this takes us, I think, to the heart of the myth, because people think they're getting an unfair share of the profits at the expense of the poor farmer.
Yeah.
And it's as I said, when you have this discussion, as I'm sure you're well aware, when you have this discussion with development actors in particular, there's a sense of sort of moral certainty that the intermediary or the middleman is bad.
Yeah.
I mean, just to put it as bluntly as I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so and oftentimes with very little evidence to back that up.
Yeah.
The question that I usually pose to colleagues who work in the development side of things when we find this is, I say to them, well, okay, let's take for a given that these middlemen are bad. Could you please develop a plan for training and equipping a set of replacements for them? Could you tell me how long it will take and how much it will cost? And who is going to assume the inherent market risks that these actors currently assume?
Yeah.
Is your project going to do this?
Yeah, right.
And that usually gets an interesting discussion going.
Yeah, yeah. I think probably this negative perception of the middleman has to do with the fact, well, that sometime you do have individuals who are quite abusive in their behavior, up to the point of stories that we often hear in some parts of the world, where, well, middlemen are similar to loan sharks. They get people in debt, and then they take away their land, and ultimately people end up as kind of quasi slaves of somebody who started as an intermediary. And yes. I suspect that has a lot to do with this very negative image that they have.
Oh, I would agree entirely, and I would go so far as to say that there probably is a grain of truth to those stories.
Yeah.
I mean, they very well may be, and most likely are,
yeah.
Intermediaries who have done that.
Yeah.
Again, my personal experience, and that's very much the paradigm from which I was, from which I've come in terms of education and whatnot. But when you go to the field, it just reality just doesn't match up.
Yeah.
And part of the reason, I think, is that as markets become a bit more open and a bit more dynamic, and again, I'm basing my comment here on Latin America, it becomes more and more difficult to really exploit in the way that you're describing without people finding ways around you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not – I mean, the market may have failures and it may be very shallow, but yet it's not so shallow that it can be completely exploited in such a blatant fashion. Mm. For a long period.
Yeah.
That's my sense.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the intermediary won't make a killing, you know, this month.
Yeah.
or this week.
Well, at the same time, if you took out the middleman, it's quite unlikely that you would get kind of a spontaneous market response that would fix all this and provide all these services, because that is exactly the reason why the middleman has such a strong position in the first place.
Exactly, and when if you look at even things like, you know, successful contract agriculture schemes, I mean they basically replicate a hub and spoke type model.
Right.
That's very similar to the intermediary.
Yeah,
I mean, I would say that many of the successful contract agriculture schemes that I know are basically it's basically middlemen set up in a way that's transparent. And effective, and basically it allows both the farmers and the purchasers to get around economies of scale.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, and they're, so, but it's definitely a role of intermediation that occurs.
Yeah.
And it involves oftentimes, you know, the provision of embedded services, whether that's technical assistance, credit, inputs, whatever.
Yeah. I sometimes also have the impression that people don't like the middleman because they appear to be so obviously rich, driving around in big cars, while at the same time, I mean, if the middleman decided that it's much more efficient to drive around in a three-wheeler, the farmers probably wouldn't trust him or her, and would think that he or she is about to be broke, and they should maybe not enter into any business relationships with them anymore.
Yeah, I would agree entirely. I think there's a whole range of perception. In rural communities about, you know, who's a good business partner and who isn't.
Yeah.
And obviously intermediaries, just by their very nature, are basically probably, you know, they want to project at least the image that they're very trustworthy and solid business partners.
Yeah, it's the same reason that banks tend to use so much marble in their buildings. I mean, they tend to project solidness by using marbles.
So no, I agree, and so there is an issue there of definitely trying to live up to the stereotype of what a good business partner or commercial partner should, you know, look at.
Yeah. Now let's put ourselves into this situation that you are confronting very often, that we are confronting very often. So we are interacting with the local community. They come up with this idea to cut out the middleman, and then we try to convince them that it's maybe not such a good idea to do that. And at the same time, there's something that you would want to do about this whole issue. So what do you do in that kind of situation?
Well, I think the first thing we try to do is get people to understand, again, very, very much coming from a value chain approach, that, you know, we're all part of the value chain.
Yeah.
And we have different roles and we have different responsibilities and different skills and whatnot. But really the value chain to function needs the commitment or the involvement of all these diverse actors. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the first step, is to say, well, you know, really, you know, how many of you farmers or local community members are willing to go every day, you know, 3 hours to the market to see what you can sell?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, really sort of try to put them in the shoes of the trader or of the middleman to see how willing they would be to assume that role.
Yeah.
One. Secondly, work with them to identify what the basket of services that the intermediaries provide really is. You know, okay, we know that they buy and sell this crop, but what else do they provide? And when you begin to delve into that, people begin to realize, well, actually, we get, you know, there are a lot of other services that we value that come through this channel.
Mm.
And thirdly, oftentimes is to actually speak to the intermediaries and see what limitations they're facing, and what kind of agreement they would be willing to come to with the producers if some of those limitations were able to be dealt with.
Yeah.
Now, those limitations may be things like not being able to access certain communities because of, you know, lack of additional transport. They may be things like, you know, lack of working capital, but oftentimes they're things like lack of market intelligence in order to move into new markets or new crops. Many of the intermediaries we've found, you know, tend to focus on, you know, a range, maybe one to two markets, oftentimes local markets, and usually on a relatively limited number of crops or goods, you know, between one and three. So if you can help that intermediary or that trader branch out and establish new networks for new products or access to new markets that are more profitable, oftentimes that person is very willing to, you know, sort of cut a better deal with the farmers.
Yeah. And doesn't that then typically also imply that you need to have a conversation with the middleman about, well, do you really want to provide all these other services, or shouldn't you maybe rather focus on only part of the value chain and do that very well and not work so much in other activities like also organizing the inputs and doing this and doing that?
Yeah, certainly we can. I mean, once you have a bit of trust built up with the trader, you can begin to discuss some of these issues.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, as you know, the use of inputs is sort of a way to, you know, to hook the farmers into the system.
Yeah.
And so it's that's a very touchy area, but that and the use of credit is a very touchy. They're both very touchy areas with intermediaries. But yes, there are definitely things that need to be dealt with, or at least put on the table and say, well, how can we do this in a way that's more transparent and and fairer to all involved?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a question. It's oftentimes a question of saying, this is the big issue I have with the development partners. You know, oftentimes intermediaries have never been seen, or traders have never been seen as valid recipients of development assistance.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So I mean, they're the ultimate outsiders in almost all of the, I would say, in all of the economic rural economic interventions I've seen. There's only one case I know of where they were actually targeted, and that was, you know, post disaster in Nicaragua after Hurricane Mitch.
Okay.
And you know, and that was a very, very much a temporary intervention to get product moving again from rural communities to markets. But you know, and it was very successful. But you know, it was one of those temporary interventions. But then again, yeah, I mean, so these are really the kind of actors where I think there's a tremendous space to do innovative things, and we don't really know what can and what cannot be done. And so my question is always, well, why don't we talk to them? Why don't we at least sit down and see what can be done?
Yeah. What I was just thinking, when you look at very competent, very competitive rural locations, agricultural locations, I was just thinking, for instance, of the melon clusters in northeastern Brazil, in Ceará. When you look at the economic structure there, you find that there are so many specialized business service providers. Those people who are working in small business development and are trying to strengthen BDS services, they would just love a place like that, because you have an enormous diversity of specialized service providers. And I'm thinking that is probably the kind of the other extreme. On the one extreme, you have the one middleman who is kind of the monopolist and who is providing a vast variety of services, but not necessarily is providing them at a high level of sophistication and efficiency.
Right.
And on the other extreme, you have very strong division of labor between various service providers who are really good at what they are doing, but they are really specializing on just one or two activities.
Yeah, I think that's a fair distinction to make. Again, what I've seen in most of the communities we've worked in is the case of the monopoly or the one trader is fairly rare. Even in very, very remote communities, because oftentimes there'll be more than one farmer who plays the role of trader as well. And so, you really, once you get beyond very, very, small rural communities and move into more municipalities, there's almost always more than one trader. Just in the way that there's almost always more than one product, even though people tell you, oh no, they only grow coffee or they only grow whatever. You always find, scratching below the surface, that there's a lot more going on.
Yes.
So I think you're right. And the question really becomes, what's the right level of equilibrium, for different size communities or different types of rural economies? On the one hand, you have the cluster type economies where as you mentioned, you can sustain profitably a range of service providers, very specialized service providers, often very high quality service providers. And at the other end, you probably can't do that. So there's the question of, well, you know, where is that? You know, what is that sort of, what are the different break-even points for different service providers along that continuum of economic development?
Right. Okay.
And that varies. I mean, we tried to set up a series of BDS service providers in Honduras and in Colombia, in rural communities. And in the case of Colombia, it was much more successful just because the community itself, while not necessarily more wealthy than the community in Honduras, just simply had better market access.
Right. Yeah.
And so the range of services that could be provided in a sustainable fashion was just that much greater.
Yeah, so it's good old Adam Smith, the size of the market determines the degree of the division of labor and the specialization that.
Yeah.
Okay.
In some cases, I mean, maybe I'm being a bit overstating the case, but it definitely, there is that role does play a role for sure.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've pretty much covered this. Is there something else that I should ask you or that you would like to mention?
Well, the only other thing is the issue that we mentioned just at the beginning, the fact that, you know, oftentimes people tend to see the middleman as the problem.
Yeah.
And my question is, well, can we be a bit more creative and see the middlemen or the intermediaries as such as actors who should be strengthened and therefore included or incorporated into these rural economic development programs?
Yeah.
And the parallel I like to draw for this is, you know, for many years, the rural, you know, moneylender or the moneylender in general is seen as, you know, terribly evil.
Yeah, right.
And for good reason. But yet I think a lot of the development that you saw in the microcredit area, you know, in the 80s and 90s particularly, was based on a very, very good understanding of what the microlenders, the informal microlenders did. What was positive, what was negative, and sort of, you know, developing models based on informal microlending that could then be used in very, very positive ways. And I think a lot of that has been built in or, you know, incorporated into effective microcredit programs today.
Yeah.
And my question to the development partners is, well, shouldn't we be thinking about doing something similar with the traders?
Yeah.
Shouldn't we be thinking about doing something as opposed to building thousands more of our famous white elephant packing sheds and, you know, and farmer associations, which only exist on paper? Shouldn't we be thinking about developing something that incorporates these people who are members of the community, who have entrepreneurial skills, clearly, you know, demonstrated entrepreneurial skills, you know, have been effective in linking farmers to market, and bring them on board as allies rather than trying to, you know, push them out the door?
Right.
And, you know, wouldn't we be more efficient if we did it that way?
Right. I think that was a great way to wrap up our conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. I think that's the message. If we can get people thinking about that, geez.
Right. Great.
Because, I mean, it just gets to be so – it's so much of a hassle to bang your head against the wall with this, you know, evil intermediary.
Yeah.